Thank you again for the invitation to come and be with you. It's been a blessing to Cammy and to me. We have thoroughly enjoyed it. We've enjoyed our time socially with you, the limited number of people that we've been able to be with. It's been nice. We thank you for extending your hospitality. And then, of course, our time together here has been especially encouraging. It's good to hear good, strong singing together. We've been missing that. And to see your anticipation, I can, you know, the mask doesn't cover all of that. I can see your attention and your interest, and that's been very encouraging. So thank you for that. And I hope we have other occasions to be together. This has just been a thrill for us to work together in the kingdom. And in a special effort like this, I think we, all of us, put more into it. I come with a little more preparation than I do normally in lessons. I'm not sure that that's better, but at least I'm trying. And I know as we come together, there's a greater anticipation of in our fellowship together, as listeners and as participants. And you know, that's where the magic happens. If I could use the word magic, is that okay? That's where the magic happens. There's always learning and growing in all of our spiritual conversations, and any example of goodness that registers and lays on our heart. But then there are those moments when we just almost feel the growth, as though we're getting bigger and we feel the spiritual growth happening. And that happens because of what's happening in our own heart. It's not the speaker, and it's not the environment, but for whatever reason, the speaker may have contributed and the environment may have contributed, but it's what's going on in our heart. I don't believe that we can operate at a fevered pitch of spiritual interest in every assembly or in every day. But we need to try to have more of it as we go along and not just wait for those rare moments where something special is happening. And I encourage us to take seriously the matter of spiritual growth and to look into the Word. We think about looking deeper and deeper into the Word, and there's some merit there, but there's greater merit in looking into the Word and then looking deeper and deeper into our own hearts. And we'll find space for that Word and apply it and take it and let it change us and make us better. And I imagine that almost everyone in the assembly has looked at every verse that I've covered, every text that I've covered in this series. You've looked at it before multiple times. Some of you have studied them carefully. And I don't have anything new to add. The effort then would be for us to take it and look into ourselves and see that would help me here and that would change me there. And so let's keep working at that. And I what I'm talking about here, I'm not speaking as a speaker at this moment. I'm speaking as a listener, because I do listen. I have occasions to listen to good teaching and then special teaching and then those moments of especially encouraging and stirring teaching. And it's what's happening in our hearts. So let's learn to cultivate that and to use that so that it's not just a rare occasion. The lesson tonight, we're going to talk about the husbands, and it's going to follow the same general pattern that we used to look at the wives in the earlier lesson today. And get going here. Okay, husbands need to be careful how you build, as we said, of the wives. In this final lessons, we're going to finish by looking at the responsibility and the role, not in that order. We're going to the role of the husband, what position he occupies, and then we're going to talk about what he does. What is his responsibility? How should he function? And then we're going to finish by trying to look at a model or a list of qualities that husbands ought to try to achieve in their lives and thus in their marriages, of course. And so let's turn first to Ephesians chapter 5, a familiar passage again. But you know, we just got to keep going back to it. Peter, he was big on reminding. In 2 Peter, I'm going to remind you, I'm going to remind you. I'm going to be sure that there are other things that remind you. I'm writing so that you'll be reminded even after I'm gone. And so thank God you've got Ephesians chapter 5 after I'm gone. And everything you need to know is in the text. Keep going back to the same passages. In Ephesians chapter 5, verse 23, "For the husband is the head of the wife, as also Christ is head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, just as the church is subject to Christ, so let wives be to their own husbands in everything." If we look at that, we see that there's a role that's established. There's a position that the husband is to occupy. What he is in this text, he is the head of the wife. That's a position of leadership. That's a position where he has some control, some decision-making power. Primarily, it's the idea of being a leader who guides and opens the way for those that would follow. The husband, as we said this morning, is head by God's declaration. If you are married, men, if you are a married man, you are to be the head in your house, the head of your wife. God said so. And you need to accept that, and you need to step up and be that. And we'll talk about how that is. You need to step up and be that spiritual leader. And I believe that the leadership that is most significant in this text is the spiritual leadership. That leadership will be felt in other aspects of life. But primarily, before anything else, you need to be a spiritual leader in your family. And you are that leader because God has declared that to be so. And so the family should be able to look to you for guidance and for example. The husband should be setting the tone in the family. Is it an angry family? Is it a scared family? Well, let's hope not either one of those. Is it a family that lives with confidence about their future? Is it a family that realizes, enjoys peace? Does the family have good examples? Does it have teaching? Is it unconcerned and not anxious about tomorrow? Because just as we are not to be anxious, but to trust the Lord, can the family not be anxious because they trust you? They've seen you in this leadership position. And so you set the tone, you set the priorities, you teach the truth, you lead in the discipline and the training of children, and you lead in keeping your family safe. You keep your family safe spiritually, first and foremost. Of course you want to keep your family safe physically from harm, so you're watching, you're being careful, and you're taking precautions, and you're praying for the safety of the family. And you want to make your family safe financially. You want them to at least be able to eat tomorrow and sleep in their own bed. And so take the leadership in that. And that's a big responsibility, that leadership in these areas. You cannot be afraid to make decisions. You cannot be afraid to step out in front and say, well, not sure which way we're going, but let's take it to the right. Let's take it to the right this time. We'll see how that works. And then, of course, making those decisions, you have got to be a leader in apologizing in your own family. You know, I missed that one. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. That was a bad decision. And that's not in any sense going to hurt you as a leader, to apologize in matters where your judgment wasn't the best judgment. But you're stepping up, and, you know, your family needs somebody to criticize. You know, the guy at the top, he's got to take it. And you need to know how to take that. And you take it with love and with patience, and you take it to heart. You know, they might be right. They might be right. And so you take that criticism like a leader ought to. Don't we want our leaders to listen to us? Don't we want our leaders to apologize when they mess up? And I think we understand those concepts. And all of that is primarily spiritual, but yes, in other matters as well. And so the husband is that leader by God's declaration. But as we said this morning, he is the leader on a practical level because the wife makes him her leader. If that doesn't happen, you really can't do much leading. And so this is, again, goes back to one of the very first fundamentals that we talked about And that is that when the husband is joined to his wife, they become one flesh. And she is willing to say, we are one body and you are the head. And I'm with you wherever you go. And he leads then. Doesn't mean that he doesn't ask her, which way do you think we ought to go? How do you feel about this? I'm not sure I've got all the facts. Am I missing something here? And you listen and you use that information because you have a great respect for this woman. You picked her because of her great qualities. And so now use her. Use her to the advantage of the family. But then you be the one to make the decision for right or wrong, to humbly apologize if you need to, but you take a stand, and holding her hand, she's right there with you. And so the husband is practical, on a practical level, he is the head because the wife is willing to be his helper and to submit to him. And so husbands, man, you've got to win her support. The text at the end of this chapter says that she needs to respect her husband. Well, you need to give her somebody to respect. You be honorable. You be wise and dignified and reverent, serious. Not just about God, absolutely about God, but then be serious about life and about your responsibilities. Jim Gaffigan is a great comedian, but he describes a man that is a joke. It's a joke. We can't live lives that are jokes. We need to be real leaders in our family. So give your wife someone that she can respect. He doesn't have to be perfect. Thank God she has already learned this morning that there's a lot of forgiveness that's going to have to happen. And she will need to forgive you frequently enough. And you ask for that forgiveness and you apologize, but then you step up and be a leader again. And be that man that she can respect. And so as said, we want to ask for her counsel and her feelings and her judgment. So being the leader does not mean that you shut everybody else out of the process, of the deciding process. And so once again, the idea of this leader is one who will give himself to the task and to the job. And we will see in a moment that Jesus then will be certainly a model for us. So that's what the husband is, and we need to step up and be that person. So, and I got that covered there. Sorry about that. And I think we did that one too. My apologies. So here we are. We're well into the lesson by now. See, that's encouraging. So what is your job, though? What are you supposed to do? It's interesting to consider here what he's not told to do. The husband has not said, be the head. I just said that. Because if that's what you are, you need to wake up and be what you ought to be. And so I said, you're the head. But the Bible doesn't go there. And I'm not apologizing for that part of my lesson. I think it's useful to think about those things, stepping up and being a leader. But the Scripture doesn't say, so now you husbands, you get out there in front and you lead. It's not what the husband is told to do. So many times in the letters, what we read are bits and pieces of instruction and rebuke and correction and guidance, because the letters are written to deal with either problems that already exist or problems that are anticipated because of what's coming. And, so fathers love your children and do not provoke them to wrath. Why that one-second statement, don't provoke them to wrath? Because that's what fathers do. They tease their kids to tears sometimes. Sometimes we fathers don't realize that the discouragement and the hurt that we may be causing our children by telling them, come on, take it like a man. Well, there's a time for that lesson, but maybe not today. And so a father's got to use his wisdom and not provoke them to wrath. So the Bible tells us, don't provoke your children. Fathers, don't provoke your children. That's not what moms do. Moms don't do that. Fathers do. And so that is going to be addressed. Men, they seem to be in the leadership position already, and they don't need to be told, now be sure to hold on to that leadership position. That's not what husbands are told to do. Look at Ephesians 5 in verse 25. We've got the husbands have their first command. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ loved the church and gave himself for her. The role is you're the leader. Your job is to love your wife. And we've got that right here in chapter 5, verse 23. But if you flip over just a couple of pages to Colossians chapter 3, you find a companion verse, very similar, not exactly the same, but in Colossians 3 and verse 19, husbands, love your wives, and do not be bitter toward them. So the command's the same. In two different letters to two different groups, the apostle is urging husbands, you need to love your wife. These aren't the only times that's commanded, but we begin to see that's the repeated instruction. You are the leader, but you don't need to be preoccupied about making sure I'm leading and I'm in charge and I'm the boss. That'll happen as your wife does what she ought to do. You'll be the leader. And if she's not letting you be the leader, there's no point in you trying to be the leader. Your best route to being a good leader still is just to do what you're supposed to do. What was that? Husbands, love your wives. That's what we need to worry about. And I know there are young men who are approaching or entering marriage, or maybe they've been married for a little while, and they feel a little uncomfortable because of our culture and our society, and they've kind of been shamed into this idea that, you know, it's all equal and you know, there's no real leadership. But I hear it preached, you know, the wife's supposed to be in subjection. I don't know if I'm keeping my wife in subjection. That's not your job, dude. You don't need to be keeping your wife in subjection. The Lord will take care of that. That's not your job. You don't need to worry about being the head. You need to worry about loving your wife. And so two passages that say that, and that's really almost the only passage of instruction for husband. Now, almost. I've got to have something else this hour. But that is the key element. And so let's understand this responsibility. And understanding the responsibility, Colossians 3:19, very short, husbands, love your wives and be not bitter toward them or against them. And what that word means, I actually looked this up. Once in a while, I'll still look up a word and make sure I've got a sense for what the original suggests about it. And this was helpful. This word bitter in the Greek speaks of to cut or to prick, something that is sharp or to be sharp. And by application, not taking it in that literal sense of the origin of the word, but in the sense that the word was used, it would mean to be short or harsh with someone. And so husbands need to love their wives, and they need to be gentle in their speech and in their treatment and their conduct. And in order to keep from speaking in a harsh, sharp, critical, cutting way, we would never do that, right? We would never have a quick answer back. Why did you do that? What's the matter with you? We know people who would do that. But how do I keep myself from doing that in order to keep from speaking and treating my wife in a way that is bitter? I need to change my heart, because in that moment, I feel sharp and I feel harsh and I lash out. That's a heart issue in the husband. So why would the Lord say, husbands, love your wives and be not bitter against them? Because we've got a tendency to do that. And for a lot of reasons, we've got a tendency to do that. The traffic getting home today has just got me in an irritable mood. Yeah, but sit out in the car for 5 more minutes, because you're going to go in and love your wife. And you're not going to speak in a bitter way against her. Or it's tax season and it always gets me going. Well, calm down, because God says you can't be sharp and harsh and bitter. Don't be bitter against your wife. That is a responsibility we need to take seriously. Love our wife. And to love, we cannot be bitter. Starting in our heart, we've got to change it. A different tone, a different feeling, a different mood and emotion, so that we can be what we ought to be. When I'm stomping around the house, and it has been known to happen, kind of growling to myself, not mad at any person in that house, whatever, that's clear. I'm just kind of angry or fed up or whatever. And when I'm doing that, and the dog goes and hides behind the couch, how do I think my wife feels right there? She knows it's not her fault. She knows she didn't do anything wrong. She knows that my irritation is not directed at her and has not been stirred by her. She knows that. But how does she feel right there? She feels helpless and weak. Not a good situation. And what about the children? They don't know what to do with that. And let's hope they don't ever learn what to do with that. What would children learn to do with that? Ignore it? Go hide? Grow up with a fear of those moments? We need to be careful, husbands. Those are the things that will keep us from really from being a leader. So the husband needs to love and not be bitter. Back to Ephesians chapter 5, there's more information about this treatment of our family. In Ephesians 5, beginning in 25, we read a bit of it already, but let's read again. Husbands, love your wives. And now the explanation is, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her, that he might sanctify her. Let me find my place. I lost it. Sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word, that he might present her to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish. So husbands ought to love their wives as their own bodies, and he who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as the Lord does the church. For we are members of his body, and of his flesh, and of his bones. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother, he shall be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Nevertheless, let each one of you in particular so love his own wife as himself. And then there's a statement about the wife, but we've covered that already. That's our job as husbands. And so number one, we love our wives as Christ loved the church. He gave himself for her. Obviously, we go straight to the cross and we see that he gave his life up for her. He died for that church, for his bride. He laid down his life and sacrificed it. And, you know, great heroes step up in the moment and do wonderfully great and magnificent things. And it's hard to imagine what it takes to do that. But it's not easy to give yourself to something or someone every minute of every day. To live. Sacrifice your life, maybe by living it, for your wife. Love your wife as Christ loved the church. He endured the temptations in the wilderness in Matthew chapter 4. He endured the criticism of these pathetic spiritual leaders of his day as they mocked him and made fun and made accusation against him, as they accused him of sin, as they questioned his authority to speak. He had to endure the weakness of his 12. I tried to count one time how many times Jesus had to tell them who the greatest in the kingdom was, because they kept going back to that argument over and over again. And I realized it was several times, because it's several times in one gospel, which suggests that they're doing it again and again and again, about four or five times at least that are recorded. That would be tiresome. But he'd tell them again. And he'd say, be like this child. And he would tell them that the servant of all is the greatest of all. We need to give ourselves to our wives because we love them. He gave himself for her. Secondly, love as Christ loved. He sanctified and cleansed the church, presenting her to himself as a glorious bride without spot, wrinkle, holy and without blemish. I love this picture. It's so telling that when we see our bride and she's in a beautiful white dress and her hair is fixed and her makeup is perfect, she's about as glorious as she will ever be. No. No. she's always going to be glorious. And much more glorious than that moment, in spite of the portrait quality pictures that we take home from that moment. He cleansed her, sanctified her, and presented her to himself. The hairdresser and the makeup salespeople, and that's not who makes your wife beautiful to you. You make her beautiful to yourself. Every flaw, every blemish is covered and eliminated. There is no criticism for her. She's been forgiven. She's been set apart to yourself. She's my bride, and nobody's going to say nothing about her. Isn't that right? That's what Jesus does with us. Are we beautiful? He marries. We are the bride of Christ. And look at us. Well, we look pretty good on Sunday morning sitting in the pew. But even then, sometimes our thoughts aren't where they ought to be. But let us go home and mess around and forget about Sunday. And he's doing a lot of covering of spots and blemishes. But he loves us. He loves us and calls us to himself. He makes us glorious. And that's what husbands do in their love for their wives. They make her glorious. No spots, no wrinkles, holy and without blemish. There's a time for us to help each other improve and get better. There's a time to say, oop, you got a little something on your face there. But our lives together must be such that the husband thinks she's perfect all the time. That's his job. But what if she's not? Well, she is. Look at her. She is. And he's made her that way for himself. Verses 28 and 29, love her as you love your own body. This is just, I think, more practical. And the point is not we need to, so let's love our own, let's love ourselves. That's what the world likes to do with that statement. It's ridiculous. So see, first love yourself so you can properly love your wife. That is not what the apostle is saying here. The apostle is saying, you take care of yourself, don't you? When you're hungry, you make sure you got food, right? You do what you need to do to take care of yourself. That's what you do for your own body. When you're tired, say, sorry, honey, I'm taking a nap. And you take a nap. That's what you do. But what you need to do is love her and treat her with the same attention and the same nourishing and cherishing and helping in a very practical way. You give her nutrition and affection. You offer her rest. You make sure that her needs are met. You're taking care of her the way you would take care of yourself. Our central nervous system keeps us posted. But you're going to have to ask, and you're going to have to observe. You're going to have to listen to properly be able to take care of her the same way you take care of yourself. Love her as you would love your own body. And love as though you're one flesh, 28 and 29. And we've spent a lot of time on this. And I just think this is such an integral part of the marriage relationship, this oneness that the husband and wife share. When there's trouble in the marriage, those two people are two people now. You think about it. Anybody, any marriage that you've ever had any conversations with or about, they don't act like, they don't talk like, and they don't feel like they have anything together anymore. They're separate people. And now that we're separate people and we're looking at each other with a wall between us somehow, there's no oneness there. That oneness is gone. And that marriage will never be fixed until they begin to embrace each other. And I'm not talking about a hug, but receiving that other soul and spirit into my own and becoming, deciding that we are one. And in this moment of disagreement, we got to figure out how to get back on the same space. We need to love as though we were one flesh. This is where we fail. We let a disagreement put a little distance between us, and we don't know what to do with that. And then resentment or bitterness or accusation or remembering history and the problems that we've had before, and it all comes back, and that wedge is pushing us farther and farther apart. And we're in serious trouble before we know it. Love like you are one flesh. And so we need to give preference to her goals and her desires. It's not just about me and mine. It can't be about me and mine. It's really not about her and hers either. We're one. It's what what do we want to do? What are we going to do? How will we resolve this? You and me. Because that's all there is for us. It's you and it's me, and we're us. And we that's where we are until we resolve whatever this dilemma is. Love as though you are one fleshed. 1 Peter chapter 3, we'll move a little bit further. And one other idea that I still think is so much a part of loving our wives, but it's not worded in the same way. And this is really the only other instruction we're going to be noticing here. 1 Peter chapter 3, earlier in the chapter, start in verse 1 with wives, be in subjection. And there's quite a bit of information there about that, the value of it and how it happens, and showing us that the wife is not powerless. She has a tremendous influence over him, etc., etc. But we finally get done with that, and there's one verse for the guy, probably because he couldn't remember any more than this. So verse 7, husbands, likewise dwell with them with understanding, giving honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers be not hindered. This is pretty dense. This is pretty full, this one little verse. Starts with husbands. We know who we're talking to. Likewise. What's that about? Likewise, like what? Likewise, how? Well, the beginning of the chapter, wives, likewise, be in subjection. We explained that, didn't we? We said, just go backwards and you find out he's been talking about all these different relationships and everybody's always in subjection. So submission to the government, submission to your masters, submission to your husbands. Husbands, likewise. He doesn't say be in submission to the wife. But that's where the likewise is. Maybe he doesn't want to compromise and confuse, but certainly he is saying there's something that hasn't changed here. And that is the fact that we yield to each other. We give deference and preference to the other. The wife is in subjection, in submission, that's clearly commanded, but there's a sense in which the husband also needs to yield and become the servant. Well, let's see what is said and see if that holds true, and you can think about that. That's at least the way I look at that. In verse 7, so husbands, likewise, you dwell with them with understanding. And so the first instruction is dwell with them with understanding. And that's something that we have to learn to do. You can't just decide to understand your wife. You're going to have to learn to understand. Understanding comes in time. It comes with education. So we've got to pay attention, listen, watch, think, draw some conclusions, keep notes for real or, you know, in the back of our head. And we need to understand our wives better. We know there's a problem there because that's where all so many jokes come from, right? We're always joking about, you know, men understanding women. We don't understand anything. And, well, those jokes are funny because they're true. We have trouble figuring out about our wives. But we just need to put forth some effort, some serious and diligent effort to really understand what's going on in my wife's head, because, you know, she doesn't always tell us everything. She's trying to be in subjection and have a meek and quiet spirit. And so while she's trying to meekly help her husband, if you're not paying close attention, you're not going to have any idea what's going on in her mind. So we've got work to do here. Husbands, dwell with them with understanding, and then do something about this understanding. Change your behavior. When I figure something out about my wife, I need to make an adjustment. Dwell with them with understanding. My living with my wife needs to be affected by what I understand about her. And so I make changes because of what I have learned about her and her feelings and her needs and her challenges. And so I've got to listen to her carefully. I've got to see things from her point of view. And I need to adjust and live accordingly. Keep going, though. Live with understanding, then giving honor to the wife And the word honor here, literally a word of lifting up onto a pedestal. You know, you give her that position of honor and esteem, lifting up, esteem, respect. And you give this honor to her. And I'll let each of us can meditate on that. How do I honor my wife? How do I lift her up in esteem? I'll not take the time for that now, but that's worth our meditation. So honor the wife as to the weaker vessel. And so we struggle with, so what's that mean? How is my wife the weaker vessel? And we just, I don't know how to figure that out, except let's just go down the list and see if we can, by the process of elimination, come up with something. She is weaker physically in strength and stamina. Okay, that is generally true, kind of, male versus female. But really, is that what makes her deserving of honor? She's very emotional. You know, that's sometimes considered to be a weakness. Well, not, you know, who decided that? And I don't think being more emotional that we necessarily need to conclude that that's being a weaker vessel. That's feeling more strongly. And our emotions that we feel strongly stir us to action and good action often. It can be bad action, but so I don't, that doesn't fit. That doesn't work for me anyway. Is she stronger intellectually? Can't even say that one out loud, right? Well, those of you who have heard the lesson Saturday and Sunday can speak up. Not now, and not literally. I mean metaphorically. Men have grown in this respect that we no longer want to enter a spelling bee with the girls or see whose wits are sharper. No, there's not intellectual superiority in men. And so in what sense is the wife weaker? Well, a wise woman told me once that it's probably because she has made herself weaker in this context. She has put herself in submission to the man. Now she's in the weaker position. She's not in control. She's relinquished that. This makes more sense than any of the others. In fact, to me, than all the others put together. And so she has made herself in subjection to your leadership. And so you honor her as that weaker vessel. You esteem her for the choice that she has made to be the weaker vessel. Something to think about. Give her honor as being the weaker vessel. And as heirs together of the grace of life. And so I think this probably means that we honor her also because we are heirs together. We are joint heirs. This takes us back to the equality. There is neither male nor female in Christ. There is neither male or female. Doesn't matter if you're a male or a female in Christ. You're standing before the God of heaven is the same. And so we're joint heirs together. And so the husband needs to be careful to esteem her because it's just too easy to forget that meek and quiet spirit and to allow it to be pushed to the side. And shame on us if we let that happen in our homes, right? She needs to be esteemed and honored. And that's not just with compliments. That is with giving her responsibility and accepting her counsel and using her as a joint heir in the cause of Christ. How important is this? If you don't do this, your prayers will be hindered. And we know what that means. That means God's not listening to you. And if God's not listening to me, I'm in serious trouble. This is a significant instruction for husbands. You don't want your prayers to be hindered because you are not paying attention to. You're not loving your wife by dwelling with them and with understanding and giving honor unto them. So, what is the responsibility of the husband to the wife? You are the head. Forget about that. That's already in place, and the wife will put you there. And so you forget about being the head. You just love your wife and all that means. and you live with her in an understanding way, showing her honor and esteem. That's your job, husbands. That's what the New Testament tells husbands to do. That's pretty much it. Well, before we finish, and just very quickly, I want us to go to a model that we can look at to kind of say, there's a good picture. And we don't have a Proverbs 32 for the husband. That would be cool, right? But what we do have are these descriptions of the elders in God's church. And if you will allow me to borrow these lists, they give me something to work on and to think about as character traits, attributes that can make me be better in my marriage and certainly in my marriage for the Lord. I need to bring these qualities home. I need to bring them home inside my heart, let them be expressed in my life with my family. These are not either or kind of things, like be sober-minded. I did that today. You know, it's not an either or one-time thing. These are qualities that we grow in. They're not absolutes like, are you baptized or not? Have you been baptized? That's either yes or a no. Are you patient? Well, we want to do 1 to 10 on that, right? It's not an either or. So we grow in these qualities. For the most part, the husband of one wife, that's important for all husbands, including the elders. And so in our families, there will be one husband, one wife, and that's for life. That's an either or. But almost all of the others really are these relative areas where we need to show growth and maturity. The husband needs to, as the text says in 1 Timothy, needs to manage his own household well, with all dignity, keeping his children submissive. For if someone does not know how to manage his own household, how will he care for God's church? So we see that, yeah, this is qualifying a man to be an elder, but what is needed to be an elder is exactly what a good husband is supposed to be doing and being. And we see that connection there. And the other thing I'd like to suggest is that we imagine the impact and the application and the effect of each one of these things in the marriage relationship. If I as the husband am thus and this and so, so what does that do? What does that bring to the marriage relationship? So while the wives focus on Proverbs 31 and imagine themselves growing in those areas, a husband can look at these lists and not only prepare himself to serve the Lord in a special way, the husbands can look at this list and make sure that their family is being led and cared for in the appropriate way. And I've kind of combined the 1 Timothy 3 and the Titus 1 list. Let's just kind of read through it. I'm not going to say so much about it this evening. But the husband needs to be blameless. That's mentioned a couple of times in circumstances that suggest that's kind of a cover-all trait. The husband needs to be blameless. That means above reproach. That means that people can't just bring accusation and they stick. They don't stick. These accusations don't stick. That means he's blameless. I threw blame at him. Yeah, but look at him. He doesn't do that. And so the idea is that that's the kind of person you want to be. That's above this kind of accusation and blame and guilt. And so, husband of one wife, of course, that's at the heart of everything we're looking at this week. But, you know, as a husband, I need to be sober-minded. I need to be self-controlled. I need to be disciplined. And again, picture the husband, and the wives can do the exercise too. Single ladies especially do this exercise too. You know, when you think about who you want to marry, you want to marry a man that we've been describing in our studies this week. You find somebody with whom you can be one, think alike. You have the same goals, the same plan to be with the Lord in eternity. And so you're looking for somebody that is sober-minded, self-controlled, disciplined, somebody who's upright. That means he's a goody-goody. He's just good. He's upright. And he's respectable. And to be respectable, you have to be respectful. He is a lover of good, hospitable, which means he's generous in helping other people. This man needs to be holding firm to the word. So husbands, does that describe us? That we're all about the word. We're going to do it by the book. We're going to do it by the book. That starts with me, and that's what we're doing in this family. Hold to the word able to teach. Well, we're not all teachers. Yeah, but you got some young ones that they need to hear you. And you need to lead in your spiritual discussions that you will have with your wife as you read together and think together, talk about the Lord's work together. You need to be able to teach. Not arrogant. You know, there's no shame in marriage. They're both naked, and that's literally on occasions, but metaphorically, they're open book to each other. I don't know what an arrogant person does in that situation. You know me. You see, what do I got to brag about? And so there's no place for arrogance, not a drunkard, no debauchery, you know, dirty living, no insubordination. That's just somebody who's always trying to buck the system. Not quick-tempered. We don't need that in our lives as husbands. Not violent but gentle. You know, that's why we don't enforce our headship. How wrong that is. Not violent. We're gentlemen. Not quarrelsome. Some families, there's more arguing going on than in other families. And I think that's the thing we need to keep in mind is there's a lot of different reasons that our families don't all look exactly the same. The patterns of behavior and how you deal with problems and how your conversations go. You know, some families just kind of whisper to each other, sneak around the house and whisper to each other. And it works. And some families, man, you want to cover your ears. I don't know. Are they mad? I don't know. I can't tell. And all families are all different. But these qualities apply always in whatever the personality form might be under consideration. And not a lover of money. Yes, I need to take care of my family, but it's not about accumulation of stuff. There's things way more important than that. And the husband needs to have a good reputation. He needs to be respected not only by his wife, but he needs to live a life that makes other people respect him. Now, these are qualifications for a man who would be an elder in the Lord's church. And so we don't expect, you know, the 22-year-old groom to have this all fleshed out yet. But single ladies that are looking for a 22-year-old who's doing pretty well, you look at this list and say, how's he doing so far? If he's on the road and he's on the way, and this is in his future, and you can see this because the seeds of these things are already present. And then early in our marriage, wives, help us. Help us to grow. But men, we need to be thinking about this and grow to be this man, and the sooner, the better. Because time gets away from us. We mess around and relax and worry about growing spiritually when we're more mature. I got some video games I need to conquer first. I got some football games I need to watch, and I've got some golfing to do, and I'm a busy guy, you know. And we think that when we're 45 and 50, but at 45 you realize that, you know, I'm still fighting those years. I'm trying to stay young, so I'm not really ready to give up all that. People start thinking I'm old, and we push off the spiritual growth until we don't ever really have a chance to catch up. But see, by that time, our family has already fallen into whatever rut we have created. And we need to create a rut for our family, a way to go that is hard for us to get out of. It's God's way. And so let's grow in all of these areas as we think about being good husbands. And so what does this husband bring to the marriage? You know, this husband's kind of boring. He just is. And right now I'm speaking to single ladies. Speaking to single ladies, boring guys don't have a lot of curb appeal, you know. Not very exciting, a little quiet. But God's just described a pretty boring guy here. He's respectable. Woo. He's holy, upright. Okay, well, that's good, I guess. Who are you looking for? And so, young men, you start becoming this man because we set our patterns early. And you don't want to have to do a battle with your own personality later in life trying to become what you should have been from the start. Let's look to the Word and bring these qualities to our life before God. And if we bring them to our life before God, we're going to find that they're readily available when we say, I do. We begin our life together and we become one. It's going to be easy for your wife to respect you. It's going to be easy for your wife to submit and follow your lead. You love her so much. You respect her so much. You honor her. You understand her. So that you can choose her favorites most all the time. You can satisfy her needs of all sorts all the time. And you can lead her and your little ones in the way of godliness. And that is a life of tremendous success. It's a great achievement to grow old having accomplished these things in your family. There's a lot of things that happen along the way that challenge and threaten it, and some days it's not very easy. But the only solution ever is to come back to these fundamental principles and serve the Lord. This evening, as we close, again we want to extend an invitation to come to the Lord. If I'm not a child of God, I'm already working at a disadvantage as a husband or a wife or whoever. And so we need to present ourselves to the Lord in faith and repentance to be baptized. And we need to turn away from our sins in repentance if we're children of God, already baptized. If there's any way that we can help you this evening, come closer to the Lord. Let us know as we stand together and sing.